providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised, we are shifting our focus more to the energy sector as we are chatting with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Now, Dan, as I mentioned, we're chatting oil and natural gas, as we always do with you, more of this monthly update. I want to start with the oil sector. And in full disclosure, we are recording this earlier on in the week before the Fed meeting. It is Tuesday, about midday through the trading day. But Dan, when I take a big picture look at, let's say, the monthly chart for crude, it was a straight up move in 2022, at least the first half. And unfortunately, for the last about year, it's been almost straight down. The last 11 of the 12 months have put in negative candlesticks. At least recently, some of these candlesticks haven't been as bad. And the price is more just trending now in that low 70s to high 60s region. But that's quite a successive amount of negative months. So, Dan, what could be on the horizon here to change this direction, this downward trend for oil?
Well, in the first part of 2022, that first half, so a week before the Russia attacked Ukraine, we were up to about 90 to 93 US dollars per barrel. Okay. Then it spiked to 120 right when the tanks rolled across Ukraine. And then there's all this talk of, you know, Europe cutting off Russian. Well, they haven't been able to stop the Russian production flow because Russia was just able to, you know, make arrangements to move it to the West. India and China are buying every barrel at $60 a barrel that they can get because Russia's willing to sell it cheaper. So that didn't come off. And then recently it's been, you know, fear, a continued drumbeat of fear of recession. And then, the Fed raising interest rates all the time. So this week, we're hoping that the Fed does a pause on interest rates, and I think that'll help stabilize that fear a little bit. But, it's just these constant talk about recession, recession, recession. And, you know, if you did have a global recession, that would lower oil demand for a while. But actually, I gave a presentation on Tuesday morning, and I showed a chart about how all previous recessions, it might even the pandemic recession, the biggest demand erosion in 1 6-month period happened, and it immediately bounced back and went back to the normal trend line in 2021. And so we got right back there. So now we're back to, you know, start of the year with a 100 million barrels a day of demand in the first quarter, but we're headed toward the forecast is that by the fourth quarter, barring a global recession, we should be up to close to 104 million barrels a day of production, which would mean we would need almost all of the OPEC production that's offline currently. So anyway, you know, there's just so much noise in the market that's keeping a lid on the oil price.
Well, Dan, that's the demand side of things. When you look at the supply side of things, it often comes down to OPEC plus, and are they going to cut? Are they going to expand? Are they going to do what they say they're going to do? Seems like there's a lot of friction in particular between Saudi Arabia and Russia. Just wanted to flag this and maybe get your thoughts on it. And that a lot of people don't believe Russia's made the cuts they said they were going to do. But Saudi Arabia came out just on the 4th of June and said they're going to even cut a little bit more and are trying to underpin the pricing. What do you make of OPEC plus, and are these promises going to be kept?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia does have the ability to defend the price of oil. Now, people need to remember that these production cuts don't show up in the very next week petroleum report, EIA or Canadian storage reports or OECD petroleum inventory reports. It takes a while. I mean, when the oil comes out of the ground in Saudi Arabia, it has to be processed, has to be loaded on the tankers, has to be shipped. So it takes a while before you really start seeing a tightness. Now, U.S. fuel inventories today, even before the impact of these cuts, crude oil is 2% below normal, gasoline 8% below normal, diesel distillate inventories are dangerously low in the U.S. at 16. And, you know, when you just look at the inventory stuff, it's surprising to me that we're not getting a more of an oil price response on the upside. But again, it's, you know, I get all this stuff about recession, interest rate hikes, and, you know, whatever. But, you know, it does take Saudi Arabia, you know, some of the countries take longer than others to try to attempt to do their quotas. But that people need to remember that 2/3 of the countries in OPEC were really not able to produce up to their quotas anyway. And the production cuts that they announced that went into effect on May the 1st, probably 2/3 of those were just to adjust the quotas to what the countries could produce. So it's really Saudi Arabia, UAE, Iraq, a little bit, you know, Kuwait, they're making some cuts, but a lot of those other countries really aren't doing anything.
So is that why we're only seeing kind of short-term moves on the back of these so-called production cuts? Because the market knows that, well, it's just, even though they're saying they're cutting, they're actually not.
Yeah, it's they announced that their July in the OPEC official report, you know, those cuts that went into it, that was like 1.16 just for the OPEC, not including Russia. It was 1.16 million barrel production cuts. They only cut 464,000 barrels per day in May. So it's going to take time for them to get to that total 1.16. So maybe next month, a couple months more. And then July, Saudi Arabia is now saying they're going to cut another million barrels a day. And Saudi Arabia has the most ability to quickly cut or raise production.
Well, Dan, maybe a little closer to home here in North America, some interesting, you know, tug of war between supply and demand, and that the U.S. is set to start refilling its strategic petroleum reserve. But there was a report out from the EIA also showing that U.S. shale output is going to be a little higher in July, especially from the Permian Basin. And so we had talked a little bit before recording today just about different areas that were growth areas. And really, a lot of the oil fields aren't in growth mode except the Permian. I'd love you to maybe highlight why the Permian is possibly a potentially attractive area for investors to consider.
Yeah, it's like half of our rigs in the U.S. are drilling in the Permian Basin. It's the only one of the major, you know, five oil basins in the U.S. that really has upside. The Bakken and the Eagle Ford have not bounced back from where they were. They're still well below pre-pandemic production, and there really isn't enough drilling activity there for them to increase oil production. And actually, in the Eagle Ford itself, there's some very, very good areas in the Eagle Ford. I mean, where some of the best oil wells in the country are Eagle Ford wells, but that's only in like Karnes County, a couple county. It's not a big area. The Permian Basin is just so much larger than these other areas, and the sweet spot. And I mean, it's got a lot of tier one acreage that still has to be drilled. So it's the only one that still has a lot of tier one stuff to bring online. So, the Permian might be going up, you know, 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day over the next couple of years, but those others will probably go decline that much. And on the back of that, in our base load, conventional non-horizontal wells, conventional oil wells are on steady decline. I mean, that production peaked, you know, years ago and has been on steady decline. So if it wasn't for the shales, we would not have. If it wasn't for the shales, our production would be down below 4 million barrels a day. And our total production in the U.S. is currently at 12.4 million barrels a day. So all that difference is all from the shales.
Can we expect this trend to change? Because quite frankly, I look at a longer term rig count chart and it was trending lower into the pandemic. And then the pandemic crashed it. It took about, let's say, 2 years for the rig count to get back close to where it was pre-pandemic, but then it rolled back over again. So it's really just a long term trend. Yeah. Why aren't we seeing any more? Is it just the story of the U.S. is just turning away from oil production?
No, it's the pressures being put on the public companies to, you know, pay dividends and do stock buybacks. And they're all really got a lot of pressure to live within cash flow and produce free cash flow and maintain their dividends. So that's one thing. Now, the other thing is that a lot of our wells in the U.S. are drilled by private companies. They're drilled by these, you know, private drilling partnerships and stuff like that, non-public companies, and they don't have as much tier one acreage as the public companies do. They can't afford to make that kind of investment and then just carry all that acreage. So they don't have as nearly as much drilling inventory. And I think a big decline in the active rig count is those guys running out of good drilling inventory, frankly.
Well, is any of it burning, or, you know, the ability to get on lands? Because at one point in time, not too long ago, people remember that not just the ESG movement, but just in general, there was a bias against investing in growth in oil and gas companies. Banks weren't financing it. The public didn't want to invest in it. Pension funds didn't want to invest in it. People were divesting from oil. Does that play into it at all, Dan, that just there wasn't the investor interest for growth over the last decade? So now that oil prices have changed a little bit, people want to see that growth and the companies aren't doing it.
Yeah, they're very much committed to live within cash flow. I mean, the U.S. public oil companies are in much better financial shape than they were, because that all that windfall that they got last year in 2022, oh, some of these companies have really cleaned up their balance sheets. I mean, they've paid off a lot of debt, and they're very committed to live within cash flow. So the days of drill, baby, drill are kind of over for now. And another thing is, they're now, a lot of their acreage is held by production, so they don't have to drill it. You know, once you drill one well that crosses, you know, two sections, 1,280 acres or so, that holds all those leases in those two sections within a drilling unit. So, and there may be 16 or 20 more drilling locations in that acreage, but they don't have to drill it. So they can slow their drilling programs. They're not going to lose acreage, and they can, you know, just live within cash flow. And I tell you, almost all the upstream companies that I cover, that's very much on their mind, to live within cash flow.
So does this make for a more stable or balanced market, because companies aren't going out there and blowing money? They are watching their bottom line, which means we won't get huge spikes in production.
Well, and then it'll also keep us from getting into a big, you know, fight with Saudi Arabia and OPEC about who's going to be the swing producer, because we're not the swing producer. The U.S. is still importing about 6 million, 7 million barrels a day. Now we're exporting light oil of 2 or 3 million barrels a day, but we're definitely a net importer of oil now. So we don't have nearly as much. So Saudi Arabia does not, no longer fears the U.S. is going to take market share away from them.
Well, Dan, we talked a lot about the U.S., talked a lot about Saudi Arabia, but what about our neighbors to the north in Canada? There's a lot of oil that comes out of Canada. What's the climate there as far as the oil sector?
Well, I wish it was better. I wish that our two countries would get together and have a more balanced energy plan. The U.S. and Canada, they got a lot of oil production that they can come up with, and we're very dependent now on that. Oil sands, we need that heavy oil to make diesel and other products out of. Some of our biggest gains have come on, you know, Canadian juniors. So I'm very bullish on the Canadian oil side.
Now, are there any big projects in North America in the oil space that could come online in the relatively near term that could either help the shipping of oil or just help the North American sector broadly?
No, other than the Permian Basin, that's the big, you know, there is some, you know, I don't cover the offshore companies that much, but there, you know, some fairly large projects down there that could bring on a couple hundred thousand barrels a day of production. But at the same time, you've got normal depletion of the other stuff that's already online. I think there would be potential for the U.S. to work more closely with Mexico in their shelf, Gulf of Mexico shelf areas. There's one company that I followed down there, Taos Energy, and it made a big discovery in Mexican waters. And then they immediately get into a pissing match with the Mexican National Oil Company about who's going to be the operator, and it delays the project for 2 years. So much of this stuff is just held up by the government just getting in the way of themselves.
Well, Dan, just talking about large public works that could change dynamics, maybe not so much in oil, but in natural gas, we hear a lot about the LNG terminals that are going to be built and how that could change the dynamics there. Let's maybe bring up natural gas real quick and just how important those LNG terminals are going to be to increase output as far as exporting.
Yeah, it's very important. We have two of them. There's Golden Pass and it's a Louisiana name, Plaquemines or something. And they're both set to come online late next year, and they are going to add about 4 BCF a day of additional LNG export capacity. And then we have, after that, there's another 5 or 6 set to come on in 2026 and 2027. that by the end of 2027, when you add all this stuff together, we should have about 40 BCF per day of export capacity, including pipelines going to Mexico and to Eastern Canada. And so when you add up all that, that's like double that. Today we have about 20 total export capacity. We're going to get up to 40 BCF export capacity. And that's when I think the international price of gas, which is based on its more on its energy content than supply and demand, then you're going to get a better price. And in fact, I just looked at Raymond James' latest gas price forecast today, and they're using in all their forecast models $5 gas for everything after 2024. So we're going to be in a kind of a low natural gas in the U.S., a low natural gas for this year, probably in the, after we get through this quarter, in the $2.50 to $3 range for the second half. Then I believe it'll go up to $3.50 in the first quarter next year, the winter again. And then we should stay in the threes through that year. And then when the LNG export facilities, we're going to get a big kick up in demand. And we should have supply and demand getting much, much tighter after 2024.
Now, is there any risk here, Dan, that natural gas drops below $2 again, goes through maybe a quick breakdown?
It would have to have a very mild summer. And I'll tell you, there's nothing but not mild. You're going to have triple-digit oil prices all across Texas and Louisiana, and it's spreading across the South. Our air conditioners are on full blast now. So demand for electricity, natural gas power plants is going to go way up this week and stay up. I mean, I'm a believer in climate the same. You know, I'm the opposite of climate change. It's climate the same. It gets really, really hot down here in the summer.
Yeah, Dan, we'll see how that AC usage spikes things, not just for natural gas, but just energy consumption in general, because it's going to take the whole energy grid contributing. That brings up maybe one more discussion just on the macro that we keep hearing that, you know, hydrocarbons are going out in favor of renewables. Obviously, that transition's not happening as fast as people think. How much of the energy market is it still important for the hydrocarbon part of it? And do you see that changing dramatically over the near term or medium term?
Not over the near term. So several places, BP is one of them. They said by 2040, hydrocarbons will still be like 75% of primary energy source. The EIA, this is our Department of Energy base case, is that even in 2050, hydrocarbons will be 80% of primary energy. And the big problem is human population growth keeps growing, and every freaking kid that's born wants a cell phone, right? That runs on electricity. Wind and solar is not delivering, will not deliver as promised. We've spent well over $1 trillion on wind and solar projects, and all it's done is gone from 3% to 4% of total of primary. And the problem is in Europe, they're shutting down nuclear power plants now. If you're really serious about reducing carbon emissions, it's nuclear is the answer. Wind and solar to get the minerals and, you know, steel and concrete and stuff and build these things, they're actually going to demand more hydrocarbon. They're going to increase demand for hydrocarbon-based energy in the short run just to build them.
What about that uranium or the nuclear power option here, Dan? We don't usually talk to you about that, but you are right. This transition to more greener energy, you do need, you would think, more uranium used for nuclear power. But do you see that picking up at all? Do you see nuclear starting to take over here?
The problem with nuclear, even if you did have government support for this program like that, it takes so long to get one designed, approved. And I think the problem that we have in the U.S., we have such a turnover in the government. People don't want to invest in a multi-billion dollar nuke plant. And then by the time they get ready to start making revenues, something changes the government and they're banned. You know, I think there's a lot of geopolitical risk of raising the capital to get them done. But I'm interviewed on a Washington, D.C. based radio show, and I've asked this question several times, and they say that in Washington, when that's brought up, all of the congressmen and stuff tell them that none of their voters in their districts want a nuke anywhere close to their home. And that's the biggest problem. As far as the supply of uranium, I think there's ample supply in the world. There's a lot of uranium in the world.
Yeah, Dan, there's a lot of uranium, but we'd have to have a higher price to incentivize new production is the challenge in the market. And so we'd have to see utility companies coming in and making it. And a lot of the growth is in Asia, or there is pockets of Eastern Europe where there's a lot of growth, but not so much in North America. So I guess if we dial it back into oil and gas, though, and where the demand's going to be coming from, what type of companies have your interest as far as the ones that can grow? While a lot of companies maybe want to live within their balance sheet, as you highlighted, investors want growth. Investors want companies that are going to be moving. Which companies or which segment of companies do you think have the most growth potential in the oil and gas sector?
Yeah, I've been doing this for 20 years in Energy Perspectives Group, and my focus has always been finding companies that I thought had exceptional growth potential. I call it running room. And that's the ones that I personally want to know. Of course, I want them to be able to, you know, not be drill baby drill with loans. I want them to be able to, you know, have cash flow. So that's what I'm looking for. You know, I just call them like aggressive growth is just kind of out of favor with the Wall Street gang. But in fact, we're having a luncheon on Wednesday, the 14th, and by Earthstone Energy. This company has grown production from 25,000 barrels a day a year ago. Their first quarter production was 104,000 barrels a day of production. And they've made some acquisitions. They've bought out these private companies and rolled them into their public company. And Earthstone is ESTE, it trades as, but I'm very bullish on it. The company has had this real low profile because they've been so focused. And I can tell you, I worked in M&A with Hess. And when you take over a package with hundreds or even thousands of wells and a whole bunch of, you know, mineral interest owners and stuff like that, it is a major project for both your field people and the back office people. So it requires a lot of your attention. And these guys are just getting out right now, hitting the road, telling their story. They're hosting our luncheon here in Houston. They're going to do a bunch of conferences. And I think once that story gets out, that's one that people should look at. But I love it when I see a company that's, you know, they're free cash flow positive and they're ramping up their production like crazy.
What about companies, some of the juniors, Dan? Are there any juniors that really have your eye that you think are doing some good work that could be on to, let's say, bigger discoveries or growth in that sense?
There's one that I really like. I mentioned on your show before, Silverbow Resources. It's an American company, but it would be classified as a junior up in Canada. It's got about a $500-600 million market cap. It's currently trading below book value. The company is extremely profitable. Yeah, this is the stock was $17-18. It's in that range. They reported 2022 earnings of $15.51 a share, earnings per share, and the stock is trading for $18. I mean, where do you find a PE ratio of like 1.2? It was profitable, reported profits of $4.18 per share in the first quarter. Based on my forecast, it's going to be profitable every quarter. And looks like to me, it's going to be in the report earnings of about $11 a share this year, which is very much in line with First Call's forecast and $17 or $18 earnings per share in 2024. Now, I'm using a $90 oil price in 2024, but this company was labeled as a natural gas producer, but really their production is very balanced. They're about half their revenues come from gas sales, half from oil sales, and they're only running two rigs. It's a pretty small company, but they've got a lot of running room, a lot of high potential acreage to drill, and it's an Eagle Ford company down in South Texas, good weather conditions. Another thing I like on these small caps is I want to make sure they have a lot of infrastructure takeaway capacity, and where they're drilling, the Eagle Ford is south and east of the Permian Basin, and it has adequate pipeline takeaway capacity, so that's not a problem. And they can even get, I think, some of their gas can go directly to the LNG exporters. Let's see, I like for smaller companies. I still like Callon Petroleum a lot. It's not that small, $2 billion market cap. I like that one. Vital Energy, VTLE. It's got about an $800 million market cap. Very profitable company. They are going to close an acquisition. the negative on that company was that they didn't have that much running room left in their inventory. But this acquisition, I can't remember off the top of my head, that they're going to close here in a couple months, is going to add a lot more inventory for them. So that one looks really good. Anyway, Magnolia is one. They're totally unhedged. It's like a $5 billion market cap company, but they pay a nice dividend. They got a super clean balance sheet. They've paid off a lot of debt, and they got a lot of running room in South Texas.
Well, Dan, you mentioned the Permian being such a big area. Were any of those companies in the Permian, or is there any other companies in the Permian you want to flag since we highlighted it as a key growth area for the U.S.?
Yeah, Earthstone is pure Permian. Vital Energy is pure Permian. Silverbow is Eagle Ford. This is a larger company, Permian Resources. It's a pure Permian company, but this is a fairly significant size. It's got about 160,000 barrels a day of current production. It's primarily in the Delaware Basin, which is the western side of the Permian. So a lot of its acreage is in southeastern New Mexico, but they have really come on strong. They're beating their production guidance every quarter. It really looks good to me. It's about a $10-$11 stock right now. My valuation is $16 on that stock.
All right, Dan. Look, we'll wrap it up here. We've talked about a lot of the oil and natural gas sector. Still kind of waiting for, I guess, both of those prices to get off the ground, but I think it has been interesting to see just how much those companies ran, especially last year, and their correction. Well, they're correcting back to a higher level here. And some of these stocks, you can make the argument, might be bottoming over these last couple months. They are starting to turn back up. We'll see if that trend continues and a turn is truly here for those stocks. But Dan, appreciate you taking time on this weekend show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in and spending your weekend, or at least some of your time this weekend, with us. Please be sure to check out our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report, to listen to all our daily editorials and company updates. We hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.